We're going to start the Health and Human Services Division. Call it to order for Tuesday, April 9th. We have a long agenda to get through today, but I think we can go past our 11 o'clock time and get it done, and we have no hearings this evening, so that'll be a nice little reprieve for some of us, although I bet we all have work to do this evening. I know I certainly do. With that, we'll start, and I will make the same comment I make at the beginning of every hearing. Again, we have still many, many bills to get through in a very short period of time. We are the finance division, and I've had several requests of members to really try to limit testimony to the finance components. Of course, you know, we need to at least mention the importance of funding these items, but if we can keep testifiers to 2 to 3 minutes total, that would really help us move along, and I know that we would all appreciate it a great deal. With that, Senate File 266, Senator Eaton, Mental Health Behavioral Aid Level 2 Certification Program. And I understand, you know, fiscal notes, we're working with the department diligently every day to try to prioritize the fiscal notes, and when they come, they weren't ready for compilation to be included in members' packets, but I think we're working on them, and they'll be coming as we hear the bills. So it looks like 266 is being passed out right now. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 266, Mental Health Behavioral Aid Level 2. Oh, we do have. Oh, good. Pretty neutral. This is a issue about a shortage of Level 2 mental health behavioral health aides. Currently, providers have to conduct the trainings and send them to DHS for some of it, and this can slow down the process and make it difficult to hire. So building on the work of the community health workers, this would create a certificate program where people could get the training and then come to the providers fully prepared. We have linked their experience in the past to count towards becoming a mental health practitioner. So this would provide a career ladder. And I will let Sue Aberholt.
Ms. Aberholt, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Aberholt with NAMI Minnesota. This would really help our workforce shortage issues by allowing people to just automatically go to a community college, get the certificate, and then go get hired, whereas right now the providers have to do the training and hire, when they hire the person, which makes it difficult, especially if they leave. So this is based on the community health worker program, which has worked very well, and I think it's great, and I'm even happier to see the fiscal note.
Yes. I am too.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholt. Any questions of members? I see the fiscal note has been handed out, and it does show a zero cost consistently all the way through. Any questions of members? Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Aberholden, I know we have a bill in higher education to look at mental health needs in the state. Do you see this as a topic that will be discussed at that point as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Claussen, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience? Senator Sharon?
No, excuse me, I didn't mean to cut off testimony. I was just willing to move the bill.
Willing to move the bill. Okay, let me ask if there's anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 266. Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves. I think, you know, I don't know where this one is in the other body necessarily, but maybe we'll do that dual track thing in case with zero fiscal, maybe the House can get it going too, and we can pass it on the floor, so we'll do the dual track thing. Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 266 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, and that it be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services bill. Any questions on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Is Senator Wicklund here? Senate File 654. Welcome to the committee, Senator Wicklund. Miscellaneous health care and medical assistance provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm here on behalf of Senate File 654. And this is a bill that has to do with Health Department of Human Services, Healthcare Administration technical changes. And I have Scott Leitz here, who is going to go through the bill. We do have an amendment, and I don't know if you wanted to consider that first, or do you want to?
Senator Wicklund, is there an amendment?
Yes, there is an amendment.
Okay.
So I don't know whether you want to consider that first or if you want to.
Well, I think it's my understanding that this amendment would address any potential fiscal. So maybe we should address the amendment first, and then the fiscal ramifications discussion should be facilitated
right.
much better.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be. Would you like to present the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, Scott Leitz from the Department of Human Services. The amendment addresses the fiscal cost associated with the bill. That was lines on page 4, lines 14 to 16. This was an amendment that was put on in the policy committee to address some concerns that were raised around access to services for certain individuals on the special transportation side. We've been working since that time with Senator Sharon as well as the transportation community to administratively address what the amendment was intended to address, and believe we've reached agreement to deal with this administratively, so this language would not be necessary, and that removes what I understand is the fiscal cost from the bill. Mr. Chair, I'll just walk through the remainder of the amendment. The next piece of which is page 7, line 7, inserting language. This is language that was being added to address the concern. This portion of the bill removes a prior authorization requirement for physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech language pathology, and moves us to a different way of administering the program to achieve the same results. What this language does is simply address some concerns that were raised with the disability community that clinics that use that have high needs clients not be seen necessarily as outliers just because their clients are using a lot of services. So this language addresses that piece of it. It's really comfort language to ensure that we take into account in determining criteria or standards that issue. And then the final piece of this on page 7 after line 27, inserting some language that gives the department some additional flexibility to procure under our healthcare delivery systems demonstration projects in a different manner. So it just expands our authority and a little bit of ability to procure with some additional flexibility in that area.
Mr. Leitz, is there any savings that would go along with that additional flexibility? Is there?
Mr. Chair, we haven't booked any savings related to the HCDSs at this point since they're up and coming. This gives us the ability to potentially expand that into the future, although it's still a voluntary system, and so we don't believe there at this time is any savings associated with it. Again, I think we're hopeful that will be the case down the road, but at this point we don't have any booked related to that.
And so what tell me more about – this is the first I've seen this expansion of authority under the – HCDS demonstration projects. Maybe describe a little bit in greater detail.
Sure, Mr. Chair. What this does is the language that exists in statute right now talks about exploration of expansion of the HCDS projects. And the department, I think we testified before your committee back a few weeks ago, under the state innovation model grant that we received, as well as sort of our plans as a department, that expansion is something that we want to do. So with the language around shall explore is really changed in this to be shall expand. And so it's our intention to expand that project. We think it's a very innovative model that has a very good potential down the road. The second part of the language simply says that as we do that, we have additional ways that we can contract. Right now that We do that contracting through our fee-for-service program as well as through managed care organizations. This gives us some flexibility to use other mechanisms beyond those two to actually do the contracting for that. So that's kind of what the expansion does.
Okay. Any other additional questions of members on the A6 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And then with the amendments on page 4 there, that takes care of the fiscal, is my understanding. So with this, there would be no fiscal implications to this bill any longer. It would be a zero. And it is, other than that, a DHS policy bill and can travel on its own. Any further questions of members on Senate File 654? Seeing none, anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 654? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 654, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you.
Senator Wicklund,
yes.
You ready for your next Senate File 1259?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm here to present Senate File 1259, which is a bill that has to do with modifying the child care assistance accreditation bonus process. Briefly, I will just say about the bill. Currently in statute, it actually lists child care programs or child care accreditations that are eligible to receive the CCAP payment differential. The organizations that are listed are high-quality organizations, and that is not in dispute, but it also, the way it's written, it does exclude other high-quality accreditors. The list was created in 2006, and so over time, organizations change, and standards may change, and the current statute, there is no process to change who is listed as a creditor. So this statute will change that to move away from the legislature picking organizations. It would move toward a merit-based system that would assess organizations based on some level of standards set by the agencies that oversee these important programs. By enacting this legislation, Minnesota will have a standards-based process for recognizing quality and issuing the higher reimbursement rate and ensuring parents have high-quality choices. And it's a good investment. The cost, the fiscal impact of this, for the most part, is due to adding additional creditors, which I believe is a good investment, and it ties funding to quality measures because research tells us that that is a good investment in our children. So I have a couple testifiers here today. We do also have an amendment. The amendment addresses an issue that came up in the policy committee. There was not a process defined in the bill if an accreditation organization lost its status and had to be lost the differential. That process wasn't defined. And so the amendment, the A3 amendment, it actually spells out that there will be a 90-day notice given if their organization that loses the accreditation, and then families and centers will be given a 15-day notice, as is done in other processes. And I understand from DHS that there is not a fiscal impact to adding this language to the bill.
Okay, that was going to be my question. Thank
yes.
you for that.
we worked,
well, maybe
we
we'll... take the testifiers and then move the A3 amendment after that.
Sure.
Looks like you have, well, I'll let you introduce yourself. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Benscofer. I'm the Director of Policy and Communications at the Minnesota Association for the Education of Young Children and the Minnesota School Age Care Alliance. Senate File 1259 is needed for three reasons. First, the current statute is outdated. One of the organizations listed is no longer in business. Second, the new process will be reflective of research and best practice, creating an application for the accrediting organizations to demonstrate their quality measures. And third, the new process will allow more programs providing high-quality care to our most at-risk children the ability to access this higher rate. We know that child care center programs that are accredited are getting children ready for school based on a report by the Department of Human Services. We also know that 50% of children are not entering kindergarten ready to learn, and that is costing the state $850 million a year. An increased K-12 education costs, reduced income and tax base, based on a report by the Wilder Foundation. The state has a considerable interest in making sure children are ready for school. We want programs to be high quality, and we want them to serve the most high-need children because this will result in more children ready for school and life. This is a smart investment and will contribute to the economic future of the state. I appreciate your time, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Benzahopper. And then one more, looks like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Lisa Wetzel, Program Coordinator for Kids World School Age Child Care with Faribault Community Education and Faribault Public Schools. We're currently in the process of becoming accredited, and we're also a rural school district who has 66% of their elementary population qualifying for free and reduced lunch, which means that 66% would then be a group that would qualify for the Child Care Assistance Program. So the approval of this and the differential is very important to our program and many programs in rural Minnesota. The accreditation process has been somewhat inaccessible to rural programs the way it's currently done. And as Sarah explained, one of the organizations doesn't even exist. So by creating this process, we will continue to be a high-quality program offering programming that can be accessible to families who may not be able to afford it otherwise. The differential allows us to collect fees that we might not collect based on our county average rate of daycare. We may be slightly above that based on the quality measures we've implemented. So this differential allows us to collect 15% above the average county rate for daycare. So thank you for your time and consideration of Senate Finance Bill 1259.
Thank you, Mrs. Wetzel. Any
Mr. Chair, I believe
comments?
There's one more. I have one more testifier.
Sure. Is that Joe Pickett? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record again and proceed.
My name is Joe Pickett. I own two child care centers and preschools. They are high-quality preschools. They are Primrose schools. And I'm here to testify on behalf of this file, Senate File 1259 as well. Essentially, it's a parental choice issue with us. We have parents that low-income parents that are willing to come to our center that would like to, but they are excluded based on the current law and the way it's enforced. So this would give them the choice of another high-quality center, which I offer them. It's a business fairness issue to me as much as anything else. We aren't able to compete fairly because the state has picked the current accreditations that will be recognized. We are accredited by another high-quality accreditation, Advanced Ed, that would go through the process to be recognized and therefore leveling, I think, the business playing field. So that is the reason I'm here to support the bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Pickett. Sorry for butchering your name a little bit.
Happens all the time. So,
any questions of members? Any further comments, Senator Wicklund?
No, I just would like to say that the legislature last year wrote the request for DHS to come up with this process. I'm not sure. I believe that was handed out or given in your packet. There was a report that was required to be completed by February 15th this year, and that was done. It's this report, and that's includes the definition of the process that the accreditors would go through to become approved. So
okay. Any questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1259? Then we need to move the A3 amendment. That's right.
Correct.
Senator Sharon moves the A3 amendment. And again, on this amendment, it appears it's a rather technical clarification language describing how an organization that is no longer going to be accredited would be handled during that unaccreditation process.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill itself, Senate File 1259, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1259, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Pappas here. All right. Senator Pappas has the next three bills, but we're looking for her. I'm sure she'll come soon. Maybe we'll take up Senate File 1510. Senator Eakin gave me the nod that he could be ready. Welcome to the committee, Senator Eakin, in this capacity.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1510 is a bill that deals with outpatient care for the Gillette. Well, it would affect the Gillette Children's Hospital, among other hospitals that provide care in outpatient settings. It's for hospitals for children with disabilities. And what this does is it addresses an inequity in the MA reimbursements for the costs of this care. And it's limited to just the outpatient care is what we're looking at focusing on here, because that's been the area of the greatest disparity and discrepancy in the payments to these hospitals. And it's been an enormous cost to these hospitals. And I think it's important to note that in the case of the Gillette Children's Hospital, that they are a specialty hospital that deals with children with disabilities and are incurring great costs that have been resulting in deficit spending for the hospital. And so for that reason, we do have today a couple of testifiers who are going to come forward. We have, let's see here, it's from the Gillette Children's Hospital. We have the CFO, Jim Hadakin, who is here today, I believe. Or is he not?
You have a video. We can get started
yes,
with that.
Yes, we can get
Maybe
started
Jim
with the video here. And again, this is to basically reimburse the hospital at cost for those costs for the outpatient care. And it doesn't just pertain to Gillette Children's Hospital. It does pertain to other hospitals as well who provide outpatient care services. And I think one of the reasons that we focused on outpatient care wasn't just because of the high costs there and the fact that the disparity is the greatest there in the reimbursements for these hospitals, but we also find that outpatient care is the most efficient way of delivering care for these children as well. And this would incentivize other.
I think that the language as it's crafted actually does apply only to Gillette.
Well, we want to open that up to, let's see.
Understood that maybe you did want to, but it would
right.
take an amendment.
Right, and we do have the A6 amendment, so okay. I should add that on before we.
We don't have an A6 amendment.
Do you have an A6?
Up here, I don't. Do you?
So.
You have one there?
I have one here, so should
I had
we have
heard rumors that there might
up,
be
so.
One, and I knew
yeah.
that this was.
Sure. That's bad.
So. And again, what this amendment would do, I can just state that what the amendment would do is it would apply to all hospitals that provide outpatient services for children. And this, again, is done in part to address the disparity that occurs there and also to incentivize more outpatient care services, which is a more efficient way of delivering these services. So so it's a cost savings for the state as well. To incentivize such care and to
have you worked with the department? Do they know the DHS? Are they working on pricing out the A6 amendment as well? We have a fiscal note on Senate File 1510 as drafted.
Right. And the department there is a fiscal note that would address that. But let's see here. And I believe that the fiscal note was for the amended version, and it did take the cost down significantly from what the original cost was going to be, because the original cost of the bill that was not amended was significantly higher. It applied to more than just the outpatient services, so that's one of the reasons it was focused on outpatient services was to decrease the fiscal note on this. So,
the fiscal note, Senator Eakin, I'm sorry to.
Sure.
Seem like maybe we need to work on this a little bit, but the fiscal note that we have in front of us is to the bill as drafted, and we hadn't really seen the A6 yet, but no, this is the A6 that we just adopted to Senate File 654.
Wait a minute. Yeah, just a minute here.
Oops.
Wait a minute.
You know, Senator Eakin, I don't mean to be putting you on the spot here. Maybe we should.
Right, we could just put this off.
Lay this on the table for a minute
yes,
and let you try to
get organized here. I wasn't expecting to be called up at that.
No,
time,
I know, yeah. And I thought, I don't know if Senator Pappas has made it yet, and I don't know if I want to do this to another member, but.
She's not there, she's present.
Senator Rosen, are you ready to go with yours? I don't want to. Okay. Okay, I think maybe Senator Pappas is ready. Thank you, Senator Eakin, and we'll approach this as it. Senator Pappas, we're glad to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just in 118 talking to Metro State alums and faculty,
yes.
about
yes.
50 of them. So luckily, Senator Chamberlain walked in. He was supposed to be doing it with me, and I turned it over to him.
Okay.
Which bill would you like me to take up first?
You know, I mean, I guess it's up to you. You got the next three.
I don't even know what the order is.
The order on the agenda says that 384, the safe harbor.
Okay, let's do the safe harbor.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm mostly going to let Mr. Bauer and the witnesses talk about the bill, but for some of you who are in the policy committee, you've probably heard this story, but for the purposes of others who are not here, oh, good to have you here, John. I just wanted to and John was actually involved with this situation. I live in downtown St. Paul in City Walk condos, and connected by a condo is the DoubleTree Hilton Hotel. And last fall, a young girl called the police from the DoubleTree Hilton, my neighborhood, saying, I think I'm going to be killed. I need help. This young girl was 17. She was a runaway from Iowa. She had been trafficked out of that hotel for the previous week and had serviced over 30 men. Why didn't the hospital notice what was going on? Why didn't somebody call the police earlier? She was just fortunate that she managed to get to a phone and call 911. The police came and rescued her, and subsequently her traffickers were prosecuted. But my point in this story is that these are things that are happening in our communities, in our neighborhoods. It can be in someone's basement in the suburbs. It can be in a hotel like it was in downtown St. Paul. And it takes a whole community to become aware of what's going on and to do something about it. And this legislation has been in the works for a while. We've been doing trafficking legislation for the last 8 to 10 years. And every year we come back to improve the laws. And this year we really are looking at approaching how we're going to approach the victims. And to see these young women as victims, not as juvenile prostitutes. Because the average age of entrance into prostitution is between 12 and 13. And no little girl says, "Mommy and Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be a prostitute." It's just not the case. These are young girls who are victimized, possibly at home, by a relative or a friend, who run away, and then they're doubly victimized by the trafficker, by the pimp, who says, "I love you," and maybe the only one who ever says, "I love you," to her. And she ends up in a horrible situation, being victimized by multiple Johns. And then the police pick her up, and then she's treated as a criminal, and she's victimized for the third time. So what we want to do with this legislation is at least take away that third leg, so that when the police pick her up, there is support, there is sympathy, there is humanity. She's taken to a secure facility, not juvenile hall, where she's treated with kindness and respect. She's given therapeutic treatment so that she can put her life back together again, get back into school, and heal. And that's what we're here to talk about, is because we really need your help to put all of this whole entire picture together and to make it work. So Mr. Bauer is going to talk about the details of the legislation.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mr. Bauer, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. Thank you for your time in a very packed schedule. We have a number of testifiers who won't be testifying today. In the interest of time, I just want to recognize them quickly. Artika Roller from the Family Partnership, Nikki Beasley from Breaking Free, as well as Sergeant Grant Snyder from the Minneapolis Police Department. They're all here, but and in the interest of time, they won't be testifying. So, and also a big thank you, obviously, to Senator Pappas, who has sponsored every major piece of anti-trafficking legislation, I think probably in our state ever. So we can't imagine sitting here with anyone other than you. So I just want to run through the bill really quickly for you. You know, it was July 20th, 2011, when Governor Dayton signed into law Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law. And what that law did was, is it changed the law in Minnesota to say that children who had been trafficked in Minnesota would no longer be criminalized. They would instead be connected to the support and services they need. What a lot of people don't know about that law is Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law actually does not go into effect until August 2014. Mm-hmm. So our Safe Harbor Law isn't in effect yet. And the reason for that was, at the time when we were passing that law, what we were hearing from law enforcement and others was, "You know what, we don't think these children are criminals any more than you do, and we don't want to bring them to juvenile detention any more than you want us to. Right. So if you can tell us where to bring these children instead, we're more than happy to do it." The problem then and the problem now is that in every corner of the state of Minnesota, the answer to that question is there's nowhere to bring these children. Right now in the entire state of Minnesota, there are 4 shelter beds for child sex trafficking victims in the entire state. And they're all in St. Paul. We estimate on the low end on any given night in the state of Minnesota that we need between 35 and 40 shelter beds for these kids. So we basically have between now and August 2014 to build that system for these kids. So let me walk through the appropriations really quickly for you. Article 3 of the bill. If you look at Article 3, Section 1, these are the appropriations that are split between the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. So if we look at Department of Health, First item is we're asking for, and this number is split over the biennium, even though it says fiscal year 2014. These would be grant funds for six regional navigators. These would be grant-funded positions. They'd be in six regions of the state, northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, and then the east metro and the west metro. They would be housed within existing organizations. We didn't want to say, here's the position this needs to be. We wanted to give regions flexibility to use a grant fund. So in one region, this might be housed in the county. In another region, it might be housed in a nonprofit organization. We wanted to give them flexibility. The second appropriation is $750,000 for a safe harbor training fund. This is something we know is absolutely critically important. There's two things about child sex trafficking cases that you should know. One is that victims are really, really hard to identify. They almost never self-identify themselves because they're under threats of all kinds of horrible things. And so unless a law enforcement officer or someone working in the emergency room or someone working in the school knows the right question to ask this child, they often fall through the cracks. They're not identified. The second thing you should know about these cases is that they're really hard to investigate.
Oh, I guess I did.
There's often a really tangled web of criminal activity behind these cases, and unless law enforcement and unless prosecutors have the training they need, it's really hard to get the bad guys, and so we want to make sure people get the training on that. Next line item, $300,000 for evaluation. This would start in fiscal year 2015 after we've had a year under our belts. This is a new initiative. It's a new endeavor. We're building something in Minnesota that literally has not been done in this country. People have parts of it, but as usual, Minnesota's building the model that everyone's waiting for so they can build it in their states. So we want to have a robust evaluation model so we know what we're doing right, so we know what didn't work, so we can always be improving the model. Next line item is an appropriation for outreach workers. This is another, to go back to the earlier point about how hard these victims are to identify, we need people on the streets, we need people in the communities who are trained to connect with these kids, to ask the right questions, to bring them in. So that's outreach workers. Next appropriation are supportive services grants. You know, these children come into our programs needing everything you can imagine, from mental health care to basic needs to legal services. And so this fund would be another grant fund. It would be available statewide, and it would be to cover all those comprehensive services that the children need. And then last for the Department of Health appropriation is we are proposing the creation of a new position in the Minnesota Department of Health. It would be the Director of Child Sex Trafficking Prevention for the state of Minnesota. This is going to be a really big job. We're making systems work together in ways that they haven't worked together. We're building a statewide system, often in parts of the state where there's literally nothing right now. And so I personally don't envy the person who gets this job because it's a huge undertaking, but we really need someone to hold this all together, to administer grant funds and all of that. Moving on to Section 2, the Department of Human Services appropriation. This one's really broken down into two main parts. One is operating dollars for the shelter beds, and you can see how that breaks down. We're requesting roughly $4.5 million for the biennium to operate these shelter beds. And I want to just say a quick note about this, because we get this question a lot. And the question is, well, can't you just put these children in a homeless youth shelter or a domestic violence shelter or something like that? And the answer is no. And there's two reasons for that. One is because more often than not, these children have a trafficker pursuing them, and their lives are in danger. And if you put them into the general population of a homeless youth shelter or a domestic violence shelter, that trafficker will have them back out before you can blink your eyes twice. And so they need to be safe and secure facilities. The second thing is that the level of therapeutic service that these children need because of the abuse they've suffered is much higher than you would find at a typical shelter. And so that's why we're requesting additional money in addition to just homeless shelter money. So you can see it breaks down between emergency shelter beds, transitional living programs, some longer-term supportive housing. And then last, a model that I'm really excited about that they're trying with some success in Portland and Seattle and some other areas, which is in some cases, specially trained foster families can be the right environment for some of these children, the ones especially where the security and safety is not as much of a concern. So we want to look at that. And then the final appropriation we're requesting is a one-time appropriation. It's $4 million for the biennium for construction and renovation. You know, we spent a whole summer going all around the state to try to figure out where we might be able to house these children. And in a lot of areas of the state, we're going to have to build it. So we're requesting this appropriation. So I guess how I want to end before I turn it back over is just to say, you know, we haven't found anyone, I don't think, who's opposed to taking care of these children. And it was Senator Sharon in her committee a few weeks ago who said, you really don't need to convince us how important this is. We know. And we've heard that loud and clear, and we really appreciate it. But what I can say is, in August 2014, the law will change. There will be children all over the state who are not in the juvenile justice system, and they need somewhere to go. And so amidst the hundreds of tough, heartbreaking decisions you're going to have to make over the next couple weeks, I really want to ask you to dig deep and find some way to build this so that these kids have a place to go when the law changes. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Bauer, before we move on, and really we do understand, I actually didn't sign a lot of spending bills, and this one was pitched to me. I understand the importance of it. I am a co-author. I'm going to ask you don't have to say it on the microphone today, but I'm going to ask how we could scale this, if possible. And so I'll work with you because I'd like to make some progress on this, but with our current targets, we're going to have a very, very difficult time, and so we'll have to have some conversations as we move forward about scaling many things that we all find incredibly important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to have those conversations with you and find a way to get this rolling.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to introduce Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, who I think is going to wrap up for us.
Mr. Choi,
Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Choi, Ramsey County Attorney, and I'm really pleased to be here and to be in strong support of Senate File 384, and I want to thank Senator Pappas for her leadership over the past really decade on this particular issue. But, you know, I really believe, and I've said this many times, that I believe that the greatest human rights atrocity that's happening in our community is this particular issue, the buying and selling of our children online for sex. And that is happening here in the state of Minnesota. In fact, in Ramsey County, over the past year in 2012, we prosecuted 12 individuals for the trafficking of children in our community. And I want to make sure that this committee fully understands that we're not talking about just kids from St. Paul. We are talking about kids from throughout the state of Minnesota. In fact, half of those kids, those victims, were from greater Minnesota. If you have runaways in your jurisdiction, then you have this problem because it is those children that are vulnerable, especially those who are runaways, who are homeless, who end up in these particular situations. And these situations are incredibly horrible. Children are threatened, they are beaten, and they go through a whole host of things that none of us could ever, ever imagine. This is happening right here in the state of Minnesota, and what concerns me is that these children, these victims, are getting younger and younger as these cases are being presented to us. I believe that in order to end the sex trafficking of children in our state, what we need to do is embrace a victim-centered approach, and that is what the Safe Harbors Bill of 2011 does. And if you do that, and if you would make this investment that is before you, we can make a difference around the prosecution of trafficking, the people that are doing the trafficking, and those are the people that we want to hold accountable. But when we have a victim-centered approach and we provide the services to these victims, what ends up happening is that these victims end up trusting the police and law enforcement and prosecution more than they trust the person that was trafficking them. And once you can make that impact, then these victims are willing to testify against the traffickers. In fact, just recently in Roseville, there was a 17-year-old girl from southwestern Minnesota who was trafficked, and because by the time we got to trial, she trusted a police officer named Ben more than she trusted the trafficker named Samuel Cozart, she was ready, willing, and able to testify. And because of that, we were able to get a conviction, and we got a sentence for 21 years. which is the longest sentence for a sex trafficking case in the state of Minnesota. But that can happen if we have a victim-centered approach, but you can't have a victim-centered approach unless you have the services that are contained in the bill that's before you to help these young girls get out of these situations and get them thinking in the right way and recognizing that what has happened to them is not good and that we need to hold somebody accountable for what has happened to them. And on a final note, I just want to end with this. There was probably in your packet a study that the University of Minnesota conducted on the cost-benefit analysis of when you make it this type of investment. It was based upon the runaway intervention program in Ramsey County. And what that study says is for every dollar invested, you save $34 of taxpayer dollars in the long run. And the results from the runaway intervention program, in order to qualify for the most intensive services for the runaway intervention program in Ramsey County, you have to have been sexually exploited two or more times. And the reason why is because we don't have the resources to cover all people. Okay? That's about 75 girls in a year. But after a year in the intensive services, with it's a resiliency-based model, public health model that connects them with a public health nurse. But after a year, on three important factors, teen pregnancy, suicidal thoughts, and incidences of self-harm, these girls who have been exploited two or more times do as well or better than the Minnesota Student Survey for that same age group. So when you make this investment, we can make a difference around changing people's lives, and we can also make a difference around holding the traffickers accountable because those victims will be more apt to testify in trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chairman, I guess we do have two more brief testifiers. Who are they?
So I think in the interest of time, what I'll do is recognize Sergeant John Vandemer, who is also here, and maybe forego testimony today. But we do want you to hear from one last testifier who is a survivor who has been working on her statement. So, Jennifer, if you want to come
That'd
up
be
here, if that's okay with you,
Mr. Chair.
Important
and welcomed.
Thank you.
Yes.
And any of these people are available for questions if I need help.
Yes. Oh, Lori.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. I'm
Welcome
Jen-
to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed. Thank you for coming.
I'm Jennifer Gaines, and I am a survivor of human trafficking. I was thinking when she was speaking, basically everything that you spoke about that happens to these young girls has actually happened during my life. And maybe this is 28 years ago, if people would have known how, they didn't know how to help me. They didn't know what was going on. And because of the whole social stigma that women in human trafficking suffer from, the places they did try to throw me into, jails, treatment centers, I didn't get any help. Instead, I became more angry and ran away further and ended up with as an adult with a sixth grade education, criminal background, scars on my body and my heart. And it would have saved me 28 years of being in that lifestyle had there been services that could have helped me. In closing, I just want to give you some statistics. I finished the Breaking Free program, and when I found Breaking Free, it changed my life. And they offered me an internship there, and I'm really grateful for that. So I would like to see them be able to help more women. In closing, I want to add that 85% of women and girls are raped and molested before the age of 18. 95% of women and girls use drugs to numb the pain. I'm nervous. I'm shaking. Hold on.
You're doing great, Ms. Gaines.
Okay. 83% of women and girls are victims of assault with a deadly weapon. 55% of women and girls have been kidnapped at some point. 60 and 90% are without safe housing, and 100% are someone's daughter.
Thank you very much.
You're just supporting her. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, I know we have a couple of questions. Senator Rosen had a question.
Don't think
earlier.
That's fine.
Okay,
that's
Senator
true.
Sharon.
No, I didn't. I just first of all, thank you really for
She's Thanking you, Jennifer.
Thank you for that testimony about the experience. I think that really brings it home for all of us. But I, along with thanking Senator Pappas, I wanted to mention that Mr. Choi from Ramsey County, I just want this committee to know that along with Senator Pappas, who's been trying to get this addressed for a long time in the legislature, it is the work with the from the Ramsey County attorney in that office that has really moved the attorneys, the county attorneys, away from the prosecutorial concept to understanding that these are victims and that the approach isn't punishment, it is intervention, and that not only is that the right thing to do for the person, but it also helps in dealing with a whole system, getting that exposed so that we can intervene on behalf of young women who are exploited sexually. So we just heard from a person, Mr. Choi, who's integral in moving the legal system towards this position of victim over prosecution, and I want to thank him for and those initiatives.
Thank Senator you, Pappas. Senator Sharon. And Mr. Chairman, also the Sergeant Vandeveer and the St. Paul Police Department have also been in the forefront of this. And if anyone has any questions from the police department, as Jeff mentioned, Sergeant Vandeveer is here.
You know, I thought the testimony regarding the delay of implementation till August of 2014 because we really don't have the infrastructure to serve these victims in anything but our juvenile system today. And it's pretty powerful testimony and really holds our feet to the fire. Any questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, can you explain what an emergency shelter bed is? And how that differs from just a shelter bed in one of our youth.
I'll let Mr. Bauer explain.
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Rosen. So the housing is broken down into a few categories. The emergency shelter bed is really, that's that first place that a law enforcement official or other person can bring a child. So they find a 15-year-old girl. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. They need to bring her somewhere. That's that first place. They know how to respond to that immediate crisis situation. In terms of a timeline, she may end up staying there up to 90 days is really the threshold until they can find either maybe it's family reunification, maybe it's a long-term transitional housing situation, but that's the first place she goes, and that's really the most critical point to connect with her with those intensive therapeutic services.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bauer, I appreciate that. I would assume that these emergency shelter beds are used by other kids that have not perhaps have in some other situation, perhaps not sexually exploited, but that are in an emergency situation. I guess my question is, and I will try to wrap it up, but is that perhaps we can use push the agendas that we already have in place with our safe harbor to ramp up and make more of an investment on these shelter beds without having to spend about $4.5 million on a new shelter going forward, because we are in a tight situation in this committee. And I understand that these, and I would presume that most of them are female that are in this situation, they do need to be handled a little bit differently than most. But I would assume we have the infrastructure already in place, and perhaps with just a little coordination with the programs that we already invest in, or perhaps will invest in, we could make do until we have a little more stable funding stream. Mr. Bauer, I don't know if that's something that you talk about with all your advocates and stakeholders.
Mr. Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen, it's a great question, and again, it's a question that we get a lot. And I do want to say I know this committee is also considering the homeless youth, the expansion of the Homeless Youth Act, additional money there. We're in full support of that as well, because we know that any child who's homeless is at extreme risk for sexual exploitation. And so, as you're considering our proposal, we urge you to consider that one as well. But again, just to make the point, there are two things that make shelter and housing for trafficked children very different, and that don't allow us to put these children in a usual homeless shelter or a domestic violence shelter. And one, and I can't emphasize this enough, they almost always have a trafficker pursuing them, and they are not safe, and their lives are in danger. And so if you'd put them in a non-secure homeless shelter, homeless youth shelter, or whatever it is, that doesn't have specific measures in place to protect them, their lives will be in danger. And that doesn't exist in Minnesota right now, anywhere. And the second piece is just the level of trauma that these children have experienced. I mean, imagine a 14-year-old girl who's been raped 20 times a day for years. You can't put her in the same situation. She has to have a level of therapy and support and safety that we also don't have anywhere in the state. And so we know this is a significant ask, and believe me, I don't envy any of you for having to make these decisions, and you have my respect for sitting there and being willing to do that. All I can do is just ask to please do your best to come up with enough resources to give us a strong start so that these kids have somewhere to go. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bauer, and I want to also commend you for your leadership. I've known you for at least almost 12 years now and worked with you in the community, so I know that you have the passion and worked so hard on this. And I was, for the record, on a co-authored and was stricken, not because I don't support this, but because there was overwhelming support bipartisan, and we want to make sure we have that on the record. So I do commend your work, and I know we have a lot of challenges ahead, and this is about our youth and the future of our young girls, and we need to do something about it, and we need to put our money where our mouth is, and this issue cannot keep being unaddressed. The more it is, the more it hurts our community. So I hope we can find ways to phase it if that's the appropriate course, but we do need to do something about it, and the time is now. So I just want to, for the record, commend your efforts and applaud Senator Pappas and all the supporters that are in this room on this important initiative. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Pappas, I have a question on the last DHS appropriation of $4 million for the construction of facilities. I'm wondering if there was any consideration given to pursuing a bonding with that. I mean, I know you'd need a link with a public entity to support it, but I'm wondering, you know, I mean, we all often try to look for another place to put some of the really high-priority items that that we just can't fit within our targets at times, and I'm wondering if there was any consideration given to pursuing bonding for that portion of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. The answer is yes. We did have a lot of discussions about whether some bonding money would be the right fit. You know, one of the issues we ran into was really the priorities of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the emphasis placed on longer-term housing options, and so the emergency shelter dollars didn't seem to be as much of a fit with that agency priority. And the other issue which you mentioned is that for a lot of places in the state, the organizations that would be willing and have the skills and expertise to step up, that partnership with a public entity where sort of the public entity owns it and you become the tenant, basically, It's been really challenging. So we'd definitely be open, I think, to bonding money for a portion of that construction cost if we could find a way to make it work. But our talks on that weren't that promising.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate this work very much. I remember voting on this 2011. And so it grieves your heart that it even has to be. One of my questions I've heard here about the girls, but I would suspect there are also boys in this situation. And I'm sure it's probably considered, but could you just mention, too, the plan for the youth in regards to boys?
Thank you for that question.
Mr. Bauer.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. There are definitely boys. We definitely see more girls come through the system than boys. The issue looks a little different for boys. So the bill is meant to cover both. And what I'll say is if there's a gap in services for girls who are being trafficked, there's a gaping nothing for boys who have been trafficked. And so it's definitely on all of our minds as something we need to address. Thank you for your question and your support.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bauer, you know, obviously this is a very important issue, and I've been, too, very passionate about the Safe Harbor bill, I'm on that, and would like to see something move in this, but I also think you look at the fiscal note, and it is daunting. And perhaps, you know, I always talk about in this committee the big whiteboard where you have these issues and you have all the private partnerships, all the entities that are funding and looking at this particular problem. We need to coordinate, and we need to see some coordination, because it's very hard when you're sitting around this table to just appropriate $11 million for this issue when you have nursing homes that are going to be closing and all, you know, our vulnerable children and mental health. And so I would love to see some movement in this area, but I also need to know that there is going to be some collaboration. I'm sure you have, but I know that within the existing structure, perhaps we can do a little bit more collaborative measures to come back to us too and say, okay, this is what we need going forward, but this is what we've done, and these are the partners that we've worked with to make sure that we're addressing this. I mean, it's going to be very hard to write out a check for $11 million. I will tell you that. But to say this is how many more beds we got last year. We are working with the Safe Harbor, the Homeless Youth Act, and this is the agenda that we need to move forward. To me, that would mean a lot, and I would assume everybody else around this table needs to know that we're not just having, again, the silos that that we sometimes do in this committee.
Mr. Bauer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, thank you. And first of all, thank you for your co-authorship on this bill. That means a lot to us. And second, again, we really appreciate the weight of, you know, I've been sitting in this committee too and shed more than one tear. I mean, the testimony from the nursing homes, and I was in here for the spinal cord injury testimony just last week, and I don't know how you hear that day after day and know you have to make these kind of decisions. To respond to your question directly, you know, we have spent the last 18 months developing this model collaboratively. And so a lot of that working together that you're talking about, I mean, we had prosecutors and public defenders sitting at the same table agreeing on something, which some of you know that doesn't happen that often. We had service providers, we had survivors, we had the healthcare industry, you know, we had law enforcement, and a lot of what we did for 18 months is we had those hard conversations then, so we don't have to have them now. And so in terms of collaboration, I feel like there's things happening all over the state, up in Duluth, down in Rochester, you know, certainly in Mankato and other areas where for the first time we've ever seen prosecutors, law enforcement, service providers, everybody involved in this issue are seeking the same thing to help these kids. And so, you know, we will try to build as much efficiency into this as we can, and we'll work together every possible way we can. You know, the appropriation that we put in, it's a big appropriation. It's significant. But it's conservative based on what we know the need will be. We built this model based on the number of kids we know about now who have been identified in our programs now. And the thing about this issue is the more outreach and awareness and training that you do, the more of these children you find. And so, you know, it isn't the kind of thing where we can do two pilot projects in two cities in Minnesota and think that we're getting at it, because it's a statewide issue. There's more and more of them. You know, for me personally, it's 0.1% of the HHS budget. I know it's a big number, but we feel like 0.1% is worth it to save these kids' lives, and that's really what we're talking about. So, again, my heart breaks the same way yours does for all the issues you've heard about, and all we can do is ask you to find a way to come up with as close to this as you possibly can.
Mr. Chair, though?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that, Mr. Barra. What is your top two priorities? I'm really putting you on the spot, I know. But if you said this has got to move forward for us to keep the program and keep the attention on this issue.
Mr. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think I'd be glad to sit down and have those meetings, and work with you. Honestly, with such a large statewide coalition working on this issue, I don't think be comfortable to pick that right now. But we'd be glad to sit down and have those tough talks and figure something out.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen,
maybe not. I apologize for putting you on the spot a little bit, but perhaps okay. is the regional navigators, would that be a top priority, or would you know that type of thing? Not necessarily the dollar amount, but the yes. but the region, whether it's a navigator or it's the increasing the emergency shelter capacity. Those are the kind of things that if we can narrow down the real top priorities of this bill, that would be helpful. Because yep. I would really like to see something move on this.
Yep. We have Senator Franzen.
To this point, can I just speak to this point?
Senator, Senator to this Franzen? Point.
I just would say, well, I want to say in a that I heard you say, Senator Lori, earlier that once this is laid on the table, that you intend to have a conversation about priorities in terms of how we can scale this back and where that should be focused. So I respect that you can't answer that question, but I clearly heard Senator Lori say, "What can we do?" And then I certainly agree that we're all saying this around the table. Senator Rosen said it, that we have all of the, and you've said it, the complex demands that are coming on this budget. And it's about trying to recognize that they all have significance and importance to us. And yet I have to say that I think about myself. I'm not saying to those of you in long-term care who are out here in the audience, I'm not saying that, or those who have disabilities and are asking for some research dollars, it's not that I'm not caring about that, but to say that we would leave children without intervention in this situation, I think would be a serious, serious mistake, and that I would prefer to ask other groups to take a little bit less rather than simply not be better about our responsiveness to this extremely vulnerable group of people.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief, but my question is also regarding coordination of resources that Senator Rosen mentioned. And I know this is a state bill, and we're trying to build a model that it would be a model for the entire nation, but my question is regarding how does this align with the rest of the country, and what coordination is there at the federal level, and can we leverage some resources there? What can you mention briefly to put it in context? How does this fit nationally, and can there be resources there that the state of Minnesota can also leverage to deal with this immediate need?
I don't know. Do you know?
Mr. Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Franzen. It's still really fun to call you Senator Franzen. I just have to say that we've known each other a really long time. So, and thank you for your question. We've spent our time out in D.C. as well, trying to set up Minnesota as a national model that could attract those types of resources. Senator Pappas has been a real leader out there. We've been out there together, mm-hmm. Talking to administration officials, talking to our delegation to get some of those resources. So the answer is possibly. We're certainly having those discussions. There's a lot of other states in the country watching what we do. You know, this is a lot like domestic violence issues 20, 30 years ago when there was the Minnesota model. It started right here. And in a lot of ways, we're at the forefront of this issue again. And so I think that could position us well to attract some federal dollars for model development. But, you know, with sequesters and all of those fun things happening out there, that's no guarantee either.
Quick
Senator
follow-up.
Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could that be part of the areas that the Director of Child Sex Trafficking Prevention position could be empowered to leverage and look into? I don't know, maybe it's already in the language of the bill, but if it's not, maybe incorporating some language there that would be the part of the duties of that position in the long term.
It's an excellent idea.
Senator Pappas. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any further questions of members?
What is?
Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 384? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 384.
I'm sorry, Miss.
Oh, is there?
There is someone.
Yes. Pardon. Welcome to the committee. State
Good
your
morning.
Name for the record.
My name is Freddie Davis English, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for 180 Degrees. And I wanted to be here this morning. And by the way, thank Mr. Chairman and committee. I wanted to come today just to be able to speak for the staff that work so often, the caseworkers that work alongside of Ramsey County with some of these young people and some of the frustration that has been expressed by not having appropriate, safe services for these young women that on any given day they're trying to find ways not to put them into the correctional system and to find those services that would be supporting them to go back into the community to live healthy lives. So I wanted to come to speak for my staff to say, please support Senate File 384 for these sexually exploited young people, because on every day they're trying to find appropriate services to help them. So I wanted to be short and brief, but I wanted to express their concerns.
Ms. Davis English, thank you for that. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 384? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 384 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, you want to take the child care absent days bill? Is that the next on the list?
That's next on the list, Senate File 115, Senator Pappas.
Oh, damn. I knew I missed it. Mr. Chairman and members, this is, what's my bill number? Senate File 115. It's well understood that children and their families benefit from high-quality child care programs with strong early learning and social-emotional development programs. And in order to work, parents need access to stable, affordable, reliable child care. Access to high-quality child care includes reimbursement for days when the child is unable to attend. Children get sick. We all know that as moms and as dads, that our children often, they pick up things from other kids at daycare or just the flu is going around. And there really isn't anything parents can do about that but stay home with them until they get well. In fact, if they try to bring them to daycare and they have a temperature, they're sent home. They often can't come back until even they've been to the doctor and the doctor says they're able to go back to child care. So this does create a problem for parents who are trying to work and trying to get on their own feet. In the past, we did allow parents 25 absent days a year, but in 2011, the Minnesota legislature reduced the number of allowable absent days for children enrolled in child care assistance program from the 25 days to 10 days, and that was effective last January. This created a barrier for working parents and places the child's track towards school readiness at jeopardy. So we're asking the legislature and the administration to reinstate the 25 allowable absent days in this 2013 legislative session. Often if parents have to stay home with their children, they are at risk of losing their jobs or they might lose their place in the child care center. And, I mean, these are not parents who are just keeping their kids home from school because they don't feel like getting up in the morning. They have jobs they have to get to, and they don't want their children to be sick, and often they don't even have sick days at their jobs. So then they get bumped back into the welfare system if they lose their job. So the bills I'm bringing you today are really preventative bills. We're trying to do some kind of either early intervention or intervention that will save money. And we've had a limited experience with the 10 days, and some parents in January, February, March already used up their 10 days
because, you know, kids can be sick a week if they have chicken pox or bronchitis or something. They're out more than the 10 days in a very early space of time. So I have with me Mr. Dan Foster from the YWCA and Jeannie Foster from two Fosters from Wilder Foundation, not related.
Okay.
Oh, Dan Evans. She wrote down the wrong name here. Sorry, Dan.
It's okay.
Who are just going to give you a little bit more insight into this problem.
Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Hi. Chair Lurie, committee members, my name is Dan Evans. I'm here today representing the YWCA of Minneapolis and the Absent Day Restoration Coalition. So when we think about absent days, I'd like us to think about child care providers. Child care providers, like in K-12, have so many slots. They have staffing and resources that they put out to provide care for a certain number of kids each day. Whether or not those kids show up, they need to be reimbursed for those costs. Now, we know that child care providers operate on very tight profit margins. So this new absent day policy is putting a lot of pressure on providers to work out this problem, because now that we're asking low-income families to take on more of the burden of reimbursing providers, we're putting them in a position where they need to tell families that if you can't reimburse us for this care on days when your child is not in care, then we need to be faced with either figuring out some sort of payment plan or simply pushing your child out of care. So looking at this from a family perspective, it becomes very difficult for families then to remain in work or school. Like when we think about this, it's a work support program. The Child Care Assistance Program is a work support program. So the families that are in this, the parents are going to school, they're going to work, they're trying to realize economic self-sufficiency, they're trying to succeed in our economy and in our state. And when these families lose their care, then that places them in a very difficult position. And in some instances, they will have to choose then to quit their job, which could land them back in MFIP, in full MFIP, which would mean more cost to the state, which would mean the state would have to help them more. And they would no longer be able to help themselves and go to school, go to work, and be able to improve their own lives and be able to, you know, kind of become self-sufficient. So we're very concerned with the impact of this problem. When we look at it from a child perspective, we think a lot about continuity of care. Children develop much quicker when they have a stable, reliable care source over a long period of time. The new absent day policy will put pressure on that and will result in many kids ending up out of their stable care environments, which means parents will either need to stay at home and, again, will no longer be able to work or go to school, or they'll need to find sort of ad hoc care environments. And I know from talking to many parents, you ask them, where are you going to find care without this provider? I'll find it wherever I can. So on a day-to-day basis, you're forced to find care of, you know, variable quality, and kids are put through changing situations where they don't have the stable, positive relationships with adults that help them become kindergarten ready, that help them develop in the critical formative years of 0 to 5. So thinking about those two pieces, there are a lot of benefits to keeping this policy at 25 days. And I just want to make a point about this limit is we see the families that are using the Child Care Assistance Program, they don't want to use these days. They need this service. They need this care. We know from years of experience that many families do not come near these absent days because they need that time to be out and be participating in work and school. The final point I want to make is about public health. So if I'm a parent from a low-income family and my child is sick, the fact that I only have 10 absent days is going to impact my decision about whether or not that child is healthy enough to go to child care. I'm going to feel a lot of pressure to bring that kid into child care, even with serious symptoms. You know, oftentimes we tell providers, well, kids come in and, you know, they seem fine because their parents give them lots of meds before they arrive. And then in an hour or two, you have an extremely sick kid and you can't reach the parents because they're at work or school. So then you have a situation where more child care workers and other child care children are being exposed unnecessarily to illness. So there is a public health component. So finally, I want to talk about the days, 25 days. So if you look at this handout that's went around, it details where the other race to the top states are. So these are other states that are leaders in early care and education. and it shows what their policy is on absent days. We received Race to the Top funding because we were among the leaders in early care and education. And yet by adopting this new policy, we have the least friendly, family-friendly policy of any of these Race to the Top states. So by adopting this, we're positioning ourselves as a state that's no longer prepared to lead and invest in early care and education. So I'd like to emphasize the importance of the 25 days for continuity of care and providing quality early care and education. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Ms. Foster, is that correct?
Correct.
Welcome to the committee.
Sure,
state your
Evans.
Name.
Mr. Chair, members of the community, good morning and thank you. My name is Jeannie Foster. I am the Assistant Director of the Wilder Child Development Center, which is an early childhood and care program in St. Paul's Frogtown and St. Paul Promise neighborhood. I am thankful that you guys are allowing me to give my testimony today and just give you a couple overviews of how it's affected not only our program, but as well as our children and families. And I'll try not to be too redundant, as you stated a lot of very crucial facts. As a program, we're constantly struggling with limited resources and funds to make to get as much programming out of every dollar that we make. But the 10-day absences are really limiting our programming. We as a program are being faced to have to decide with our families who have now maxed out these 10 days, and here it is April, if those families are going to be able to stay. We're being creative with creating payment plans to try to allow them to make some, what we're looking at is continuity of care for these children and their education. As an employer, our costs stay the same. Whether kids come to care or not, just as was stated, we have to pay our bills, we have to find food, we have to pay our state and licensure fees and our teachers' fees. So looking at this and how this reduction is making it very difficult in our program to serve both low-income families and maintain our financial stability in the community. One of the big things for me, I have to say that, you know, funding early childhood investment is a big task for you all, and I appreciate you guys taking this into consideration. We talk about the closing the achievement gap, but for me, I feel like this is about preventing it. When children have consistent, stable care, they're able to maintain that care and be ready and productive to be in kindergarten programs, learning at their best. For families, that means they're able to go to work and have the supports in place and feel confident and capable about their ability to be productive members of this community, as well as their children getting the needs met in a quality program. If I can share one parent's story, Erica, she has two beautiful boys. She's a working mom, minimum wage, but she has a son that has chronic illnesses. Her family has maxed out her days. With this tough flu season this year, his asthma was inflamed, and he was hospitalized for four of those days and then kept home in two different intervals of days for those. So this is a support. This has been a support for her, and now she's faced, if I could read what she said, I can't live off of that. It's not what I want for my kids. I want to work, but I can't without child care. And due to my son's chronic illness, I might have to go back on welfare. I don't want to do that. That's not what my kids need to see from their mom. Another concern, as was talking about before, was about the sick kids and a public health issue. Sick kids need to stay home and get well. And that's just the bottom line for it. As a parent walking in and you see a child snotting and puking, how does that make you feel? The concern is, oh, my goodness, is my child going to get sick from this? And having that understanding of, as a program, as a provider, they're expecting me to take care of the rest of the children in this program. And so how that is affecting our programs with this 10 days is they are medicating their children, and they're bringing them to school sick. And after a couple hours, when that medication wears off, then we'll realize the impact of that. But it's a long-term impact going, and it could be one from one child to infecting the entire population as well as teaching staff, so that we're all looking for other care for our families or are needing to take sick days from jobs. And as you say, a lot of our parents who are working these minimum wage jobs do not have sick days or PTO days or time off that they can take if they're allowed. In closing, I also wanted just to talk about the variety. We talk about kids missing school and sick and illnesses as being one of those priority reasons, but there are a variety of reasons why our children miss school in days. In a state where 4 out of 6 months there's extreme weather and illnesses, kids are missing buses, cars are breaking down. You might have families that need to go visit grandma or grandpa and just want to take a day off with their children. Just this last week, it was spring break, and I had 3 parents asking me for permission to keep their children home. I felt like I was, it was a really tough position for me to be in, understanding that you have 10 days. That's what you have, and I understand. And one mom just said, I've had my kids, I have three kids that have been home this week. They've spent time. I would love for my son just to be home. And I couldn't give her that permission. That was a decision that she had to make based on her own family's needs. So the situation of the 10-day has, and I really think it's just unintentionally created a roadblock, and we're hoping that you all, as good investors, you guys got your work cut out. I hear that clearly and loud, and you have to make some really big decisions. But as a provider and as a parent, I'm asking you to consider how immediate January 1st became for a lot of the families in this community. I'm also asking that you consider Erica's story and the other parents that are similar to her in this community. Mm-hmm. And help them stay on tack by reinstating the 25 absent days as well as the medical exemption. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Foster. Do you have one more testifier, Senator Pappas?
We have one more.
Is that Melissa Bowl, parent? Is that correct?
Hi, yes.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Melissa Bowl. And I am a single parent of three daughters, two of whom are in daycare. First and foremost, I need to thank the state of Minnesota for having a low-income program that allows me to be employed. Without it, I could not work. I am a single mother with three daughters, two of which attend New Horizon Daycare. I work full-time, yet still struggle to make ends meet with my income. My 7-year-old Milana has a chronic illness of asthma. This illness many times has caused her to be so ill that she misses school and daycare. As her sole provider, I then have to miss work, which is unpaid. Due to having two children attending daycare, because of the rules, if you're not at work or looking for work, your child cannot attend daycare. So therefore, I don't have one child missing. I have two who are accruing days, and myself losing wages. How can I now pay for care for my children who are not receiving because of illness? So why not stiffen your rules? Have medical excuses from health providers? Have allowance for siblings when someone in the family is ill? What is happening is sick children are being brought to daycare. Parents have no choice, therefore are putting all children at risk health-wise. Children in any daycare or school environment get more ill. So why take away medical excuses? The families who rely on daycare assistance, let's face it, we're poor, okay? How can we afford to call into work, then care for our child, and now pay for a full day of care, which, by the way, is more than I make in a day? None of this makes sense. Do you want families to succeed and be self-sustaining without assistance, or force them out of a job, and now the state has to fully support that family? Has this been thought out fully, all aspects? Because I'm nervous every time my child gets sick, wondering if I can afford it, not focusing on caring for my child to get healthy. Nobody can plan for emergencies. If we could, then your system would work. I don't even think about myself getting ill. I work in food, and I go to sick because I cannot afford my kids to not be there. I can really not afford for my children to accrue absent days because I am ill. My children are already at 9 days. My child has not even hit her bad season for asthma yet. I have no clue what I'm going to do. Without this program, I cannot work. Without work, I can't support my family.
Mrs. Bull, thank you for your very personal story.
Wrote that
Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to ask Ms. Bull a question.
Can you come back?
Yeah, there's a question. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bull, I'm just wondering, with your situation and your experience, is 25 days enough when you have a child who's dealing with that? I understand what that's like when one of the parents has to stay home with a sick child. Is 25 days enough in your situation?
Well, when the 25 days were intact, you could then have medical excuses. So say, for instance, you know, my daughter goes to a respiratory therapist. When my daughter has asthma, she's out of school for a week. She has bronchial asthma where she vomits and pukes. It's horrific. Now, I'm going to bring my daughter to the doctor. I'm going to get a medical excuse. Then it doesn't go against those 25 days. With the 10 days, I can't even do that. It doesn't matter if my child is hospitalized. It doesn't count. You know, so how does that work? And I, like I said, I don't have one child. I have two. Because of the rules, if I'm not at work, I can't bring my kids to daycare. So now I have two kids that are accruing these days. I have one more day left, and it's April.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, it sounds like 25 days is a workable
number.
It
is, yes. Especially okay. Because there is medical excuses.
With medical excuse.
Yeah.
Any further questions of members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, if you have a Mr. Chair, if you have a situation where you have a medical excuse, then what are the 25 days used for if the medical ones don't count?
I think, Mr. Chairman, it would
Senator
be
Pappas.
For illnesses that don't warrant going to a doctor. I mean, if a child has the flu or a cold, you don't necessarily take them to the doctor, but they still have to be home sick.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, we worked on this bill last year. In fact, it was my bill, so paragraph C was reinstated for parents under the age of 21. That was something that needed to be adjusted because I believe this exemption going down to 10
yes.
days was in 2011, and then we adjusted it last year, I believe, for the younger parent.
I recall that.
My question.
And, Senator Rosen, that was helpful.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure, Senator Pappas. My question is on the fiscal note, and maybe Mr. Albrecht can give us some guidance. Does that seem the $4 million for the biennium? Is that – oh, there is no Mr. Albrecht. Okay. Or perhaps we could get from the department if that seems to be about the going rate, the $4 million for the biennium. Compared to when this was eliminated back in 2011 or adjusted in 2012. I'm just trying to figure out if the $4 million seems a little high.
Yeah, 4.8, actually. I mean, when fully implemented, if you look out, there must be some interaction in fiscal 14 that it's not a full year somehow in the way this is done. So, I mean, if you look at 2 years after that startup, it's the implementation
right,
date
right.
that keeps fiscal 14 lower. So,
Mr. Chair, I guess I just was looking at a comparison of when this was scaled back in 2011. I know the costs have gone up and all that, but still, it just seems a little high.
What do you recall what the savings were?
I do not.
You don't. DHS is here. Maybe Mrs. Rowe is it? Is do you recall what the savings booked for reduction of the absent days was?
Mr. Chair, I'm Elizabeth Rowe from the Department of Human Services. These savings are fairly consistent with the savings that were booked in 2011. There was one other change made in 2011, which was that we no longer pay absent days for legal unlicensed providers. And that is a change that is not being reversed in this bill. So that would be one difference. The data in the fiscal note is taken from case information in the payment system for the child care assistance program.
Thank you, Ms. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, the department leads. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the forms that need to be used for documentation, those are provided by the department. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we did have a form when this was an available policy, and we would be reinstating that form if the bill passed.
Any other questions of members? Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would only like to highlight that on a fiscal note, you can only see the savings for the state, but based on the testimony that we heard, there are definitely more savings to the community and to society having folks being able to get to work and providing for their families. So this is, we're trying to save money on the books, but the unintended consequences of that is that we have people that don't go to work and they are not able to provide their families and are even deeper in poverty. So let's not forget that.
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Pappas,
and you really point out a flaw in the way we do our fiscal notes.
Yep.
It's very difficult for us to do prevention when even if we have, evidence-based documented research that shows that you're going to save money. You may not save money in the biennium in the case with a trafficking bill,
Or even if you think you're going to save money in the biennium, you don't have a balance sheet that says it costs this, but we save this, you know, therefore it's a good idea to do it. It's really unfortunate. I think it really limits us moving forward in doing good human policy.
It's a problem that we've talked about many, many times in this committee in particular. I mean, a lot of the investments that we make don't necessarily pay off in the time frame that we're looking at or within our budget area. And it's very difficult to make these hard decisions that we know have a significant return on investment. Some additional comments on that, Mr. Evans? Is that what you're back up for? Okay. Other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 115? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 115 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas, Senate File 699.
Yeah, I have. This is the doula bill. I'd like to ask Ms. Lane to join me, and I think we have another testifier.
Yeah, I'm in our pocket.
Is it the same one? Mr. Chairman and members, this is the Pappas Day in your committee, I think. This is another bill which I'm proposing that will save us Medicaid dollars. And testifiers are going to talk in more detail, but just as a reminder to the committee members, if you're not familiar with doulas really do provide assistance for women during childbirth and often before and after childbirth. And they're that kind of support network for them. They can often be there to communicate with the hospital, to communicate to her what's going on, to provide physical support, provide emotional support. And what we found, and we have research that demonstrates this, is that women who have that kind of a trained support person with them have better birth outcomes, are happier with their birth outcomes, they're more satisfied, they even like the hospital better, and they're less likely to have a C-section. And that's really the cost benefit here, is when we can save costs to the Medicaid program, and this bill is specifically aimed at that, that's better again for our pocketbook as a state. And so this is really a win-win situation. I'm going to turn it over now to Ms. Lane, who's going to talk a little bit about, I think, the research that backs up this position.
Ms. Lane, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Susan Lane. I am the coordinator of the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition, which is an umbrella group of nonprofits, various professionals, not only doulas, but also midwives, psychologists, and many others who serve birthing women in Minnesota. I want to thank you and the committee not only for letting us be here today, but for the support we've had over 10 years. We came here first in 2003. And because this committee and this legislature has legitimized doula care by giving women a right to doula care in this state and by creating a registry for doulas, we've been able to continue to practice and have served probably in the vicinity of 25 to 30,000 women over that decade. Unfortunately, the majority of those women have been, like myself, white, educated, middle-class women. That's because there is no third-party payment at all for doula care, so women who get this care pay out of pocket. We do an enormous amount of volunteer work. We have a volunteer program that one of the other testifiers can talk to you about in our prisons. Called ISIS Rising. I am a volunteer with something called the Alithia Project. I serve mothers who are HIV positive. All of this is done without pay. We often do work at reduced pay. I have not gotten my full fee yet this year. But the women who most need our care, and doula care, I want to point out, is most effective when it is peer support. So I am a peer to the middle-class white women that I serve and who pay me, not to the to the women I volunteer with, and that hurts me and it hurts them. It works. It's better than nothing, but it isn't as good as it could be. So what I'd like to point out is that, first of all, the research is golden research here. We're not talking about studies that are contested. There are dozens of studies. You have a list of them there. You have a referendum from the Public Health Association, a resolution. We're talking about the Cochrane database. We're talking about the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, A rating. There's only four preventive applications in maternity care that get that A rating, and doula care is one of them. So without belaboring the research, because I know many of you know this and you can certainly ask questions, I'd just like to add that what we're wanting to do here is get funding so that possibly as many as your fiscal note indicates, 20%, and we'd hope it would be the most needy 20% of women on Medicaid could have the benefit of peer support doula care that is prenatal, that is through the birth, without interruption, continuity of care, and postpartum in their homes. Doulas, when I work with a woman, I see her in her home, I know her family, I know her husband, and I'd like to point out that our care complements many other initiatives that you're dealing. And I should also point out, by the way, that 40% of births are Medicaid births. So we're talking a large amount. The kinds of things that we do are we identify abuse issues. We see them. We're there. We know when they happen. We work with care workers. We work with case coordinators, social workers, coordinating care with permission of the parent. We work on tobacco cessation. 25% of women in this state still do not get even a pamphlet about smoking cessation when they're pregnant. We know this from the Rural Task Force of the Health Department. But we're there to talk about it. We work on it with them. We make sure that they're getting the benefits that they're entitled to. We do this because we work in conjunction with other providers and with other supporters. I'd also like to just mention that doula care can be a bridge, a workforce bridge for women in these low-income communities who would like to move up in all areas of healthcare, and this has happened. It certainly happens in our community. We start out as doulas and we become nurses, community health workers, midwives, all the time. It's a common bridge to other healthcare work, and we would like to see that bridge working in the low-income communities where it would be most effective. I think the question really, I would like to really just make a couple of comments about the fiscal note, if I could. And that is that the person who wrote the fiscal note was very generous. They offered us 50% more than we're requesting in doula fees. We don't want 750 a birth. We want 500. And the reason that we arrived at that figure is that it is comparable to comparable workforce training. So that's in the market. It's a little bit less than an LPN earns, and this is a little bit less training than an LPN gets. So we were using workforce comparable figures to come up with that, which substantially reduces the top number that you've been shown here is $1.5 million. At $500, it would be $1 million. At $600, if it were to go up over the years, it would be $1.2 million, which means that the benefit to bring this service to 20% of Medicaid women in our state would cost us as a state between $500,000 and $600,000. And I think compared to the costs you talk about generally, this is chump change. I also want to point out that, just as Senator Pappas suggested, there is no way for our fiscal notes to indicate benefits. But I'm going to pass this over to my colleague, Mary, so that she can just give you a clue. Every study, and you also have a letter, I think, from Dr. Cozumel at the University of Minnesota, who did a cost-benefit analysis of doula care showing a 40% possible reduction in cesareans alone. And she only addressed cesareans. Doulas also, women who work with doulas also have significantly, as Mary can testify to, better birth weights. They stay out of NICUs more often because we're there in their home in their refrigerators, going through their food supplies, making sure that they are healthy in so many ways that no healthcare professional right now can do, and at a fraction of the cost of other home visitors, a fraction. So as I said, it's a much lower figure that we're looking for here long term. The other thing is that there's an error here in that we weren't looking for 2014 money. We were looking to be able to pass this bill to put doula care in our Medicaid plan and to work with the Human Services and Health Department staff that we have worked with somewhat to date, yeah, more with Health Department, to come up with a proposal for CMS that will meet their requirements as the state of Oregon has done. So, but again, the health cost savings just from if we actually had just the rate that Everyday Miracles has of cesareans, if that were the rate for these doulas, they're working strictly with Medicaid moms, and if their rate of cesarean section were the rate of all of the women that would be served with Medicaid dollars, it would save $1.5 million a year. And by the way, these savings are instantaneous, and they are health care savings. So
thank
I would like
you, Ms.
to.
Lane. You have another testifier, Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Thanks.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record
Mary Williams.
And proceed.
Mary Williams. I'm the one of the co-founders and executive directors of Everyday Miracles. Ironically, we've been around since 2003. We've served over 3,000 women in birth and many more families because we do, along with doula services, we do education prenatally, postpartum. We also have prenatal yoga. Moms come in just to get breastfeeding support. In the process of the moms working with us, we have a contract with one of the Minnesota Medicaid insurance companies to provide that prenatal education. We can't serve anybody else that's not contracted with us, simply because we don't get reimbursement. And we use those dollars to reimburse our doulas for the birth because we are not reimbursed for the birth. When our doula works with the mom, she works with the mom from the beginning whenever the referral comes in. Our referrals come from everywhere: social services, public health nurse, midwife, doctors, clinics. The doula then will meet with this mom 4 or 5 times prenatally at least. Also meeting with the family, like Susan says, we go to the homes, kind of get an idea of where we can refer them out so they can get the other services they need. Because one of the things that's lacking that we've seen over the years working with these moms is there's not a connection sometimes between the social services, and we might have a public health nurse that's working in the same office with Healthy Start, but they haven't hooked this mom up with Healthy Start. So that's part of our role, too, is to refer them out to all these services that are out for them. And the moms are willing and want them. So when we look at our statistics, it's kind of a no-brainer. We look at it and go, why hasn't somebody figured out that this just works? Women supporting women, it just works. Women that go through our program, they breastfeed 97% of the time for at least 8 months. That's not even the 2020 prediction for healthy people goals. That goal is 81%. We've far exceeded that. And it's just supporting women and letting them know how to do this and knowing that they have a place to go to if they have trouble after they have their baby, which you can only get a couple of hospital visits with that consultant, you know, that's going to help you with lactation. When we worked with 500 women in our study, 409 of them delivered after 37 weeks. That's huge. So our prematurity rate is drastic. It's drastic. Also, the women that we work with don't really seek out help from their providers all the time. So we can hook them up with a clinic, with a hospital. A lot of them don't know where they're going to deliver yet. They might be 38 weeks when we get them. So it's kind of a guidance, too, through the system. Plus, knowing that there's going to be somebody there for you, you're not going to have the fear when you walk into that hospital room, and you're not going to use as many interventions. Therefore, you're not going to have as many C-sections. Just kind of a cycle that we go through with fear. Let me think. Women of color are a majority of clients. Maybe 30% are our Caucasian girls that are on the system, but women of color, and we do match our cultural women, like our Somali women, work with our Somali doulas. We have 17 languages, so there's a connection with these women already. We're looking at a C-section rate that's significantly lower and saves tons of money, too. So it's kind of a no-brainer.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, just to point out some of the handouts in your packet, we have a letter from health providers in northern Minnesota who are very supportive of doula services. We have a letter from a proud father of two little girls who used a doula service. We have... what is this?
That's the
Public Health Association resolution. And then we have the letter from the physician at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. And I think Ms. Lane was just going to wrap up with a couple comments.
Yeah, I just want to point out that there are several models for doula programs already running here, including several in the inner city. There's the Cultural Wellness Center in South Central Minneapolis and other many other programs that are there, but most of them are working on either no budget or raised money or budgets that change from year to year. So it's been difficult. But all levels of government have in some way or another given some support to doula care already. And there is no controversy about the research. It's 100%. It's not challenged.
Thank you, Ms. Lane.
Thank you.
You suggested that there were some issues in the fiscal note that might be problematic, and so I'm going to ask somebody from DHS to come up and maybe speak to that. There was, I believe the suggestion was that the $750 should have been $500 and that the start date was incorrect, and certainly we'd want to know if those are true to get the fiscal note down if possible. Mr. Holtman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick Holtman with the Department of Human Services. So if I understand your question correctly, it's how did we come up with this rate? And I think we looked at the rate that we're currently paying to physician extenders that provide prenatal education. And we don't have anything else to go on at this point. We would probably, in developing a rate, we would look at similar providers and sort of what they get paid at this point. So,
And then the start date was the other issue that you brought up, that you thought that it maybe started faster than
right.
Was intended to start?
We're proposing that, like other states have done, Washington in the past and Oregon most recently, that our Department of Human Services request a waiver from Medicaid, which would be necessary to pay doulas at this point in time. Actually, it may not be necessary a year from now because of work that's going on in Washington, but at this point we have to assume it is. So what we're asking for this bill is to put it in our Medicaid plan pending CMS approval for Medicaid payment. But it takes a period of time for that to kick in. It generally, the process of getting that kind of a waiver takes anywhere from 4 to 6 months or longer, but usually within a year. So if we include it in the plan now and we spend time in the next few months working with DHS to fine-tune this plan according to what the CMS requirements are, supervision by a licensed state professional and so on, that if we spend the time doing that now and then put the application in by 2014.
Ms. Lane, the fiscal note assumes that DHS will be able to secure the waiver in time for the January 1, 2014 start date that's spelled out in the bill. So, I mean, I believe that one right. Probably is sound. And they are our single state agency charged with negotiating with CMS, so I would assume that the January 1, 2014 date is sound.
Obviously.
Okay. We do have a couple of questions. Senator Claussen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, doula services, are they currently covered by insurance carriers like Blue Cross, Health Partners, et cetera?
They are not. There is...
Ms. Lane.
Excuse me, sorry. Senator, they are not covered by third-party insurance now. I shouldn't say never. Sometimes they are. We submit bills, and sometimes they're paid, and they're paid more often in other states than they are here, but not consistently anywhere yet.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. Any idea how many pregnancies are serviced by doula in the state on an annual basis?
Yeah, it's somewhere in the – and again – because there's no formal record keeping of this, but based on the numbers of doulas we have and the average numbers of births that they do, it's somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000.
Thank you.
And four of these are in hospital-based. Some of these are in hospital-based programs. There's four hospital-based programs in the metro area, run by the nurse managers.
So the hospitals have determined that it's worthwhile for them to have staff doulas.
Yes, Senator, they have. In fact, these programs at Hennepin County, it's been going on for also almost 10 years. And in spite of budget cuts at Hennepin County, Unity, Woodwinds, and Fairview, they have chosen to continue their doula programs. It's that valuable to them.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Pappas, it's fun to see this bill here. Senator Pappas and I have a history going back prior to legislative work in supporting midwifery in general. And these things, but especially the doula, is such a low cost for value returned. So it's a really effective program in that regard. And I wish it were covered by regular insurance as well. And I think the statement of these hospitals that hire them on staff is a demonstration of the value there. But especially I thought it's a health focus instead of a medical focus. And I think of some of the personal and the customized. Can in every community you can have a doula that can relate, such as Somali or white or whatever you want to have, and that is an important component. But it's exciting to see this bill. I hope that I would expect that, considering the current situation, that doula services are quite well recognized now and should be accepted by CCMS. So good to see the bill here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Senator Pappas, any further comments? Anyone from the audience wish to speak either in support or in opposition to Senate File 699?
I would just make one final Senator comment, Pappas. And that is I always encourage my daughters to get doulas, to have doulas that go to the hospital with them. And since I have 15 grandchildren, it's really important advice.
Okay.
And they say, Mom, can't you just do it? I say, no, I'm in Minnesota. You're in Israel. You have to get a doula.
And do your daughters listen?
They do.
Okay. That's the
not about birth control, but they do listen about
that. Okay. Okay. hence the 15 granddaughters, I guess. grandchildren. Okay. Seeing no further testimony from the audience, Senator Kiffmeyer moves Senate File 699 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Pappas. And I know you said it was Senator Pappas Day today, and you don't have to worry about that. We had three Senator Hayden days already, so this is nothing.
That's true.
Members, we've had some more fiscal note issues. Senate File 762 is not going to be ready for today. Senate File 1510, we witnessed a little bit of the work that needs to be done on that one still. It's not going to be heard today either, so we will move on to Senate File 1472, Senator Carlson, the health-related licensing board appropriations.
I did. It's good for me. And my wife did. Hey, whatever she's to do with it.
Senator Carlson, welcome to the committee in this capacity.
Senate
File 1472.
Senate File 1472. It's about the health and health-related licensing board appropriation. The HLBs, or health-related licensing boards in Minnesota, make it their mission, and were created by the legislature to protect the public's health and safety by providing reasonable assurance that people who practice are competent, ethical practitioners with the necessary knowledge and skills to successfully fulfill their title and role. Each board, comprised of governor-appointed members, oversees the regulation of health-related professions in Minnesota. These board members who work in Minnesota community outside of the state government, and in addition to their role on these boards, put in extra hours to offer public and professional expertise to the Minnesota state government. Senate File 1472 contains the appropriations for most of the health-related licensing boards, with the exception of Dietetics, Nutritional Practice Board, and the Board of Medical Practice, and the Board of Nursing and Board of Podiatry. Many of the boards receive a one-time increase for rulemaking in 2014. And to explain a bit more about the detail of it, I have Mr. Randy Snyder here, who is actually Executive Director of the Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators.
Mr. Snyder, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Randy Snyder. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators and the Minnesota Board of Optometry, and co-lead the Administrative Services Unit, which is our back office for all 18 entities that are housed together at 2829 University Avenue. There are 15 health licensing boards that are housed there. Today you have 11 boards before you with change items. Many of those executives are here to answer your specific questions. With me is Julie Vagsness. She is the accounting supervisor, the CFO, as we refer to her, for the boards, and she's our technical expert. Our role today is to be very brief. I truly do not envy your role and hear the many appeals in front of you. Ours is fairly simple. There are 11 of the 15 health licensing boards here that are in the special revenue fund. They do not receive general fund dollars at all. They are all fee-driven. We must raise 100% of our fees to operate. We must maintain that operational standard of having at least $1 left in our coffers at the end of the fiscal year. We are 100% fee-generated. None of these proposals will require any fee increase. So we are not going back to our licensees to ask for any fee increase. Many of the proposals that come before you in a change item were approved in the last biennium, and they were just not completed, such things as rulemaking. That's a $44,000 budget given to us by MMB. We have to have a placeholder in order to spend, be authorized to spend our funds. Again, there are 183 citizens who drive our boards as board members. This has been vetted through them. Your decision today is really that final step that we must come before you and seek spending authority to spend our funds, and that is essentially why we're here with these change items. The base budget was submitted within the governor's budget, and it was to be a flat budget. These are the extras that will make us successful over the next biennium. We know of no opposition to this. And basically, we need your permission to spend the board's fees and in spending appropriation for the next 2 years. The detail was just handed out to you in a little single sheet here. And if you have specific questions, Mr. Chair, of Julie or myself, many of the board executives are here, too, if there are specific issues within the stated requests for the change item increase.
Senator Carlson, there is one general fund one towards the end of this bill. Are we going to address that separately later on in the testimony? Or,
Mr. Chair, yes, Senator Carlson. We have someone from the Emergency Services Medical Board.
And here. So, yes. Mr. Snyder, you're not, you didn't present on that item. You left that for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a very notable issue.
Yes.
There is one general
it's
fund
one that
board
just jumps
here.
Off the page
and,
to those watching
yeah,
our spreadsheet.
And I was going to exclude them entirely. However, Pam, Executive Director Bilibeau, is here to answer specific questions. EMSRB is a general funded board, and there are three general funded boards that collaborate with us, Barber's Cosmetology and EMSRB, to share in our collaboration over there, but they are general funded. We include them in many of our endeavors, but they do stand alone in that fact that they are general funded and should stand for your questions.
Okay. I guess so we'll allow members' questions regarding the special revenue fund supported boards, and Ms. Vagsness and Mr. Snyder, as they're here. Any questions of members on these provisions? Okay. Thank you for that testimony. We will invite Pamela Bilodeau from EMSRB to present on general fund. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pam Bilodeau. I represent the EMSRB, a 19-member board. I am the executive. I serve as the executive director for that board. Our primary role for the emergency medical services throughout Minnesota is ambulance services, education program approval for EMS training, and a list of others which I will entertain in just a moment. I just wanted to first of all mention that, as Mr. Schneider mentioned, in the interest of efficiencies, we did group together our bill, our request in the bill, and rather than get 18 or however many bills. So we are general funded, and we realize that this may be a difficult request due to tight budgets. And we do understand that. And the reason for the request, however, is that we are unable to support several programs that support public safety. And those are programmatic requirements that are listed in statute. And there was a handout, I believe, that was given to you earlier, just outlining a little bit about our requirements, our programmatic requirements for public safety in Minnesota. As I mentioned, those include ambulance licenses. There's 421 licenses. Licensed ambulance services that require inspections, and that's 846 vehicles every 2 years. Investigations, they can vary. There's an average of about 45 investigations each year. Certification of pre-hospital care personnel. We certify about 30,000 pre-hospital care personnel that work on ambulance services in hospitals. There's five levels. One of them is fairly new, the community paramedic level certification, and that's been very successful in answering some of the return on investment, so to speak, to look at cutting costs for health care. Minnesota State Reporting Ambulance System, that allows medical directors to look at improvement of health care within their ambulance services and make improvements. And that data is also available. It's national data that's available, which also helps with decision-making, Accountable Care Act, and those types of things. There's a placeholder for future healthcare improvements and what's required. So that's something in the future. And we also, the notable mention is that about 65% of the ambulance services in Minnesota that provide emergency response 24/7 statewide are volunteer. And so a lot of what keeps those ambulances running, and many of the board members that volunteer their time have touch points with every healthcare portion of the system. And many of the people on the board have volunteered. I myself am a retired firefighter and also a retired EMT. And so those volunteer services are incredibly important when that call goes out for ambulance service. And the other portion is the emergency medical response, which is also on call 24/7. It's very much a low incident, but high consequence. And you can think back to the bridge collapse. And those are the importances of supporting the programmatic pieces. The reason we're here today is more of an informational awareness. We do realize that things have changed, unfortunately, since we put this request in. And it is a high request. And Senator Mr. Chair, you pointed out that it does sort of jump off the page, and our intention, we do realize that, and we're not meaning to be unreasonable. We're looking at this as an informational opportunity to talk about what we do with our board and for the state of Minnesota. And also a notable mention are those services and industry that we work collaboratively with to look at how we can make improvements. With that said, we do thank the committee for their consideration. We did, in a handout, talk about maybe some options. If there's any consideration that you're able to give this, we do understand this is a very difficult year. And so the consideration alternative solutions would be maybe half of the request, dropping it down to 493,000 in the initial that's set up for operational overhead. And so with that, in the interest of time, I will just hold for questions on any of the programmatic pieces. There, I did talk a little bit about what we do with them. Most of it is proactive or foundational, and many of those programs are not funded and unsupported because we were unable to fill positions that support those programs because of lack of increases or increases to our budget in other areas. So thank you. And with that, I'll hold for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bilodeau. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do appreciate the work that's done here. But when I see other boards and their support on the boards is through the fee structure, such as the previous boards presented here, doing a very good job, and you know, I've built up a great deal of credibility of how they handle their resources and what they do, very fee-driven, special revenue fund, and so on. So when you say general fund, sometimes it's general fund appropriated, but there are fees also deposited into the general fund. Is that the case with this particular board?
Ms. Bilodeau.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Kiffmeyer, I understand your question. I believe that, and it's about $80,000. It alternates the year we receive fees from ambulances, services for their licensure, and it goes anywhere from about $60,000 one year, an alternate year when we include the metro area because there's more services. It jumps up to about $80,000 to $90,000, and that does go back into the general fund. As I mentioned, that 65%, that's why it was so notable, of volunteer ambulance services. Many of them are very small. They struggle in greater Minnesota to be able to provide that service over a wide area. And that's why those fees are lower, and my understanding of the history is that's why it is general fund. Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you,
follow-up?
Mr. Chairman. Yes, and when was the last fee? When was this fee originally set? How long has it been?
My understanding is that it's been set since the statutes became into being, and there's a couple of dates. One was we were within the health board, and I don't have the initial date. EMS has been around for about 30 years, and then in around 1995 was when we became a standalone board, and I don't believe there's been an increase since then because of volunteer base. Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer, a follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, I just think that I think this just shows an area that needs a little more work, I think, in regards to this particular board. So I just want to make that comment.
By work, you mean money.
Well, I think they got to take a look at their fees. Everybody else has done this. We recognize the volunteer thing, and yet this is still something, though, that boards are generally supported by and have a foundation of those fees. And if it's been that long, I would like to see something like a plan to bring the expenses of the board and maybe even structure them as a special revenue fund instead of passing through, because we can still have the legislative oversight, mm-hmm. but it helps very, very much, especially for us as in the legislature, to see the balance between their fees and their board structure, and also really helps them. I'm glad to hear you're with the Administrative Services Unit. I know that's really helpful. But I think, nonetheless, the work should be supported by your fees, is my opinion.
Yep. Senator Claussen?
Yes, thank you. A question about the EMS education. Is that like continuing ed for your members?
Ms. Bilodeau.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Claussen, yes, that is, it includes continuing education. It also includes that initial certification, which is a much, it's coursework that's required for that certification.
Currently, is that not being provided through a lot of our technical colleges as far as training, certification, continuing education?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. That is we have approximately 170 education programs. Many of them are with fire departments that are medical response units, as well as ambulance services. They support the ambulance service units, as you can imagine, with a wide area coverage, that or with ambulance responses, emergency response. There are certain calls where the extra help from fire departments when they are on scene is invaluable to the outcome for that patient. And that the training is provided through the Minnesota State Colleges, as well as the fire departments offer that training. There's a variety of ways throughout the state of Minnesota that training is provided because of the need and because of trying to provide just-in-time training, whether it's at drill nights at fire departments or for the ambulance services themselves. And because of travel time, that's a consideration. So they may do it on site and be an approved education program, as well as the Minnesota State Colleges. Thank you.
I'm just wondering if
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if there needs to be some greater coordination between the MNSCU institutions that provide certification. And if, in other words, a lot of professions invest with their people for recertification, going back to school, et cetera, paying the fees and so on. I'm just encouraging that we do that with the MNSCU organizations around the state and the EMS providers, or EMS providers, that so we're not duplicating things and making it more efficient, perhaps.
Ms. Bilodeau?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do coordinate very closely. In fact, several of the we have an EMS work group that's for educators that are peers supporting peers. Again, it's that 65% volunteer, that if those volunteers were not there, they supplement a lot of their time, and that includes some of the education that they provide themselves, so that the cities and those ambulance services that are volunteer are able to do that training in-house, and there isn't a fee for them. So that's part of it, and we do work very closely, and we really want to thank our educators that give their time to work with the best, most efficient ways of providing that education. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions of members? You know, Ms. Vagnas, thanks for staying at the table. As I go through this, I do see quite a few additional FTEs in the various boards here. I don't know. I mean, it looks like a couple in the dentistry, one in marriage and family therapy, one maybe more in the nursing home administrators, not entirely clear, a couple in pharmacy, several in EMSRB as just described, some one-time costs, the DRLM IMS, which is the disciplinary one. I see that's a one-time cost, and it was appropriated once before, it looks like, and wasn't carried forward. So maybe that one it's actually a fairly sizable portion of it, that one-time one. But I am concerned about adding all these FTEs that, you know, even though it might fit within the fee structure because of additional balances that we have today in this fund, I worry that we're setting the stage for needed increases in these fees in the not-too-distant future if we increase FTEs at this level. I'd like to ask that question on the record, at least, and see how long we think that the current fee structure would support this additional level of FTEs.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I were to kind of go down, my name is Julie Vangsness, actually.
Yeah.
If I were to kind of go down the list, if you looked at the summary report, maybe quickly highlighting where some of those FTEs are and how they would be supported in the current funding structure. The Board of Chiropractic, it's a portion, it's like a part-time FTE that they would just bring on temporarily during the renewal cycle. In their current funding structure, we wouldn't have any issues in funding that in the out years. Again, it would be a temporary person, maybe brought on for 8 to 12 weeks each year. The dentistry board does have a couple of permanent positions added to the HPSP program. Those are funded through all of the health licensing board fees. And so it would take several years before we would have to increase fees throughout all of the boards to cover that, because they each pay a portion of those fees to cover this program.
That's right. And the HPSP, the Board of Dentistry oversees HPSP, which is the self-reporting of chemical dependency issues and the likes and mental health issues, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Marriage and Family Therapy, their increase in the FTE is a part-time person, and then also increasing the current executive director, who is now working part-time to permanent. This board does bring in sufficient revenue without having to do any fee increases throughout time, and they license associate marriage and family therapists, which is new to the group a few years ago, and that's where that additional funding is. We had also looked at reducing fees for this early on, and that was not included in the governor's budget for that particular board. The Nursing Home Administrators Board, the staffing increase would be an IT position. This was supported by the minute. And what we had done in the past is we had a temporary staff in there that the boards pooled money together to fund, and that pooling of money isn't any longer in the Administrative Services Unit budget. So in order to pool money again through all of the boards, through the Administrative Services Unit, we would need that appropriation there. The Dr. Lims system, this was a system that was approved 2 years ago. When we brought our RFP to Minute, it was not approved at that level. And then through the Sunset Committee, there was a Sunset report that was done to look at what is the best system for the health licensing boards, and that was delivered in January from the Department of Administration and Minute together. And so what we're asking for is to have those funds reappropriated to us so that we can move forward on those projects. We have not done anything with them at all. There's rulemaking both in nursing home administrators and in optometry, physical therapy. None of those boards moved forward with the rulemaking. We were delayed through the sunset review last year, and so we're basically, all those funds will cancel back to our fund balance on June 30th, and we're asking for those dollars to be reappropriated for the next biennium.
As you're describing the rulemaking, $44,000 is the amount in most of those?
That would be an estimated cost if there were major hearing that would come out of those rulemaking dollars. These are estimates that we receive from the I think it's the Secretary of State's office and the
Department of Admin, probably.
Yep. Yeah. And then also through the administrative law judge. That's where the larger the cost would be if there was a hearing at the end. Now, these usually these are specific in our appropriation bill, so if those costs weren't at those levels, anything not spent would just get canceled back to the fund
balance.
Okay,
so you could spend up to that $44,000 in pursuit of rulemaking, and if it wasn't spent, it would just go back to the special revenue fund.
Correct.
The balance.
Yep.
Okay.
The Board of Pharmacy does have two full-time positions in their budget, and I know that their executive director is here if you want additional information, but he has the funding revenue coming in to support those two positions. And then let's see. The Board of Veterinary Medicine is looking for just a part-time position. It's a 0.5, and that board, too, does have the funding to support it in their fund balance. I do have a fund balance worksheet. I think I had sent that on earlier to Dennis, and I can forward that on to you again, too. That has our complete fund balance of all of the boards. We have about, I didn't bring it up to the table with me, I want to say that it's close to, at the end of fiscal year 13, we anticipate to have I think it was around $13 million in that fund balance. And at the end of fiscal 13, we do anticipate that some of these dollars will be canceled. For instance, like the Dr. Lim's budget, we couldn't do anything with those funds. So those will all get canceled back down to that balance, and we'll increase that balance.
Okay.
And then EMSRB, which is general funded, and Pam did comment on that budget itself.
Okay. Any additional questions of members? Thank you for the additional clarification. Anyone else in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1472? Senator Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to address in general some of these things, because having chaired the Sunset Commission for 2 years and working quite intensively with all of these folks, but several of these things were in response to some issues or concerns that brought up as far as setting standards for turnaround time of complaints for customer service, that collecting these fees and doing these things. So every one of these I recognize as an issue that received a lot of intensive work and is very focused on serving either their members that provide the fees, giving them better service, or complaint processing for patients or others as well, so that they can respond effectively. They also work with the Attorney General's office, so there's been a lot of work, a lot of people involved in regards to targeting the use of their fee dollars for this. So I just wanted to speak in support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So we now have Senator Carlson moves Senate File 1472 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Carlson. We have one bill left on our agenda, Senator Rosen, Senate File 373. Members, we are getting a first engrossment in our packet as the bill as introduced. Apparently, this was heard in Health and Human Services, and there was an amendment adopted.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yep.
So that should be being passed out along with the fiscal note, I believe, it looks like.
Right. And the fiscal note, Mr. Chair, is zero.
We like those.
We start off good here. So, Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly explain what we did in health policy.
Absolutely.
And what the bill is about. Thank you. Senate File 373 is about modifying the MA coverage to include consultations with psychologists. And then in the health policy meeting, we put to advanced practice registered nurses. And that is to create a pathway to provide integrated care that recognizes the comorbidity between the mental health and substance abuse and chronic physical conditions. So hopefully, Mr. Chair, you do have the first engrossment with you. I would like to offer the A2 amendment.
All right. Well,
and this amendment, Mr. Chair, as when it gets passed out, will just really narrowly define what the advanced practice registered nurse is, you know, what her scope of practice is, which is certified in psychiatric mental health. That's basically what the A2 amendment is.
Hers or his, I mean.
Excuse me?
Hers or his. There's should be gender neutral. I mean, there's APRNs that are.
Yeah, you got me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize.
Yes. So the Senate the fiscal note that we have with the zero is drafted to the first engrossment that we have before us, and now I haven't seen the amendment yet. Sounds like you're narrowing the APRN even further. So, I mean, presumably the fiscal note would stay zero.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. Just making sure that we clarify it's certified in psych. So after nurse on the A2 amendment on page or line 10, it would go certified in psychiatric mental health. That's what the A2 amendment does.
Certified in psychiatric mental health. Okay. Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment. I think it's a good clarification. Any further discussion of the A2 amendment? Seeing none. On Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay. On the bill, then, as amended, did you have some testimony?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have Dr. Tricia Stark, a licensed psychologist, a Minneapolis provider.
Dr. Stark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Rosen said, I'm Dr. Tricia Stark, a licensed psychologist. And I printed up some references in case you need advice on bedtime reading for the committee. This bill looks like just a payment issue, but it's really about creating a pathway for integrated care that recognizes the needs of the whole person. As we know, comorbidity between mental health, substance abuse, and physical health is huge, with 68% of mentally ill adults having some kind of chronic condition. And it's estimated that 70% of primary care visits have psychological drivers. But this is Finance Committee. So at the very most, this would be cost neutral from what I can see from the various studies. A review of 91 studies found that the presence of this kind of service reduces costs by 17%, and if people do not have it, it increases the rate by 12.3%. Another factor is for individuals who present with physical complaints because of their psychological disorders. Studies have shown that this is also budget neutral and also increases the satisfaction of the primary care provider. And then another study says, in sum, care management by mental health professionals, social workers, psychologists, or psychiatrically trained nurses, and we're not talking about care management, but the next part is, and consultation to physicians by psychiatrists or psychologists are the methods that are currently have the evidence supporting their effectiveness and cost effectiveness. And I know there's mental health professionals are not well paid, and there's a tendency to kind of want to jump on this with a Me Too kind of thing. But this really is about a specific service so that a diabetic psychologist at Park Nicolet's International Diabetes Center could consult with the primary care person somewhere else, or in the health psychology program at the U could consult about epilepsy or other issues.
Thank you, Dr. Stark. And we got your list of your bibliography here. And anytime I see the professional magazines with five authors, you know I'm all over it. For bedtime reading, I'll.
I bet you are. No, I will.
Any further testimony, Senator?
No, Mr. Chair.
This is, you know, this ability to consult is all joking aside, it is very critical for patient care and appropriate patient care, and so I thank you for bringing this forward. Any questions of members? Senator Eakin.
And I have an amendment, and I don't know if I can offer that right now or if you wanted further discussion on the bill itself first.
Okay. Yeah, no, offer the amendment.
Okay. I'd like to offer the A3 amendment. And, Mr. Chair and members, this amendment simply adds the clinical social worker to the bill. And the reason that I offer this, Senator Rosen, is because the clinical social workers do perform the same services that the psychologists do. And for that reason, I think that they should also be included in this. And we have put in for a fiscal note to see if there's an additional cost to this. But I thought that they should at least be treated the same. I think it's kind of an issue of just fairness and parity here. So I don't know if you consider that to be a friendly amendment, Senator Rosen. Or
thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eakin. Well, this is not an unfriendly amendment. I've seen some unfriendly amendments, but but I am a little reticent about accepting this at this point until we see what it does to the fiscal note. I also would like to, you know, this bill has been narrowly crafted. There has been discussions. We did make a change in policy to put the advanced practice nurse on there, and that was heavily discussed. Unfortunately, Senator Sharon had to step out, and we had talked about this social worker potential being put on this bill, and because she is an advanced practice mental health nurse, and we kind of thought that perhaps just take some steps at a time here, make sure everybody's on the same page and that there is some comfort, because the bill originally just started with the psychologist and then we expanded the last committee and now we want to expand it again, and I'm just a little concerned that there it is going to get quite broad. So if I could be guaranteed that the fiscal note would come back as zero, then I'd probably be a little more open to accepting it, but there hasn't been any discussions with the social worker advocates on this bill. So,
Senator Eakin, you said something about having talked with DHS about the potential fiscal ramifications. Is that correct?
There's been a request that has been made for a fiscal note on this, Mr. Chair, Bill Straczynski is here, has been representing the social workers working on their behalf. I think he would appreciate a moment to be able to comment on this, if that would be possible.
Yeah, that'd be possible. Maybe, and before we're done, maybe I'll ask DHS the status of their consideration of this as well and the potential costs in order to weigh it. But, yeah, if there's additional testimony to be had regarding the social workers, the clinical social workers.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen,
if Dr. Stark could say a few words too, please.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Stark?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the social workers provide a very valuable service, but it's usually about care management and not about consultation about specific disease entities. So I do think that there's a difference in the kinds of services provided.
Okay. Mr. Straczynski, you'd care to offer some testimony on the A3 amendment?
You can stay if you want to. Okay. Oh, there he is.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm representing the clinical social workers. And I apologize to Senator Rosen the last several days for coming late to the party, if you will. I know how difficult some of that stuff is, and certainly having been involved in mental health, these issues in the past for a good number of years, I appreciate this opportunity to present just a little perspective. With respect to clinical social workers, in those situations, I know they do therapy sessions. They work with the depressed mothers. They work with children and those things. They're doing the same thing. They are consulting with physicians now. They're just not being reimbursed for it. And so I thought that this was an opportunity to present this information to the committee in an interest of parity in those circumstances where it's the same, let them also get reimbursed because they are making these same consults. Now, Rule 29 clinics, it's all coming back to me. Rule 29 clinics, they do bill through psychologists, but certainly then the psychologist in those Rule 29 clinics should be authorized to reimburse for those services for the social workers who are interfacing with physicians, because it does happen. I mean, there's faxes and there's conversations going on, children in abuse circumstances and what have you. So that's the whole issue. I have diagnostic numbers and all those kinds of things, quotes. We don't need to get into that, Mr. Chairman. I just think it's a parity. In those circumstances, should there not be a fiscal impact, and we've asked, we would hope that the committee would look favorably upon this as well, because they have their own independent license. They've got many of them in independent practice have their own MA provider numbers, and that's our story. But thank you for the opportunity to present the situation. And
thank you, Mr. Straczynski. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because of no fiscal impact, where would this travel? Would this go straight to finance or rolled into your
I was planning on dual tracking this because we don't know. I don't know what. Do you know what the status of this bill in the other body is? If we dual track it, then you can match up with them if they see fit to send it forward, and you can pass it on the floor if there's zero cost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If this amendment were to go on and DHS isn't able to assure us that there is no fiscal cost, I would not send it on with this amendment on it. It would stay here for possible inclusion. So I mean that's kind of the what we're.
Right.
Working on here. And then the dual tracking would be to help you make sure that it stayed alive and we wouldn't just send it on in case, you weren't able to match up with the House or something.
Right.
We'd be able to put it in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, we did have a conversation yesterday outside of the chamber about this. The language, as it says, clinical social worker, I was... advice from one of my constituents just late yesterday afternoon about a licensed independent clinical social worker. And so I really don't know the difference between all these different licensed social workers and what would be the difference between having that designation versus just a clinical social worker. So it would take a little bit more work, I think, and a little more comfort by everybody. To put this on, because I certainly don't want to ruin the work of the psychologists that have brought this forward. And I'm willing to continue to work on it, but I definitely don't want to see this fiscal note before I tank the whole thing. So I'm not quite sure what to do.
Yeah.
Should we lay it over or just pass it?
I'd be willing to take your advice on that. I'm told that the status in the House is that it is stuck in the finance division, and they're not able to. They used their deadlines a little differently than us. They said that even bills that get heard in finance need to be heard and referred out of finance by second deadline. And they can't refer bills out of finance past second deadline. And so if it's a bill in the House, it's in finance today, it has to go into the omnibus bill if it's going to get passed. That's their interpretation of their timelines this year, and that's why we are doing this dual tracking on some things and allowing it to go on. If there's no cost, it's okay with us. If it passes the floor and the House changes their interpretation of their timelines, it's okay with our committee, but we keep it here in case the House stays with that interpretation. We'll be able to match up with them and keep these provisions in our omnibus bill, too, and be able to match them up in that way. But there may come a time when some of these provisions that are very important to members and important to the state of Minnesota get tied up in various processes, and the House may reconsider whether they can let bills go or not. So if that, maybe we can call DHS up though and ask them the where they're at in the consideration of the fiscal implications of adding clinical social workers to this proposal.
I don't
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick Holtman with the Department of Human Services. The reason we have a no-cost fiscal note on this, I think my understanding is that the consults have been a recent add to statute, and so we don't have a huge number of claims. This is a fairly new Medicaid service, from what I understand, in medical assistance. So we're usually more comfortable sort of giving a fiscal note from a base. And I guess I'm not prepared right now to comment on whether adding social workers would generate additional costs. My understanding is that the section of that law is really for pharmacy consults, and I don't know if this is within the scope of practice, but I'd want to check with chemical and mental health, and unfortunately they're not here right now. So.
Okay, and so did I hear you say that brand new Medicaid services would get a zero fiscal cost on? Is that
no?
No, I didn't. I misunderstood. Okay.
So with that, Mr. Chair, I think I would respectfully decline this amendment. I just think it needs a little more work, maybe a little more time next year, and we can adjust with that. But I would hate to jeopardize the work of the psychologist in the advanced practice.
Senator Eakin.
And Mr. Chair, and I respect your opinion on that, and just thank you for letting us get it on the table and have the discussion here today. So I appreciate that. And so I will not move the amendment, or I'll.
Senator Eakin withdraws his motion on the A3 amendment. So then we have the bill back before us. Is there any further testimony on Senate File 373? Anyone in the audience care to testify either in favor or in opposition? Mr. Lehman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Lehman. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants, who are licensed to prescribe and do have a number of physician assistants in the state that do specialize in psychiatry and mental health services. We believe this is a good bill, but it could be a great bill. And Senator Eakin started down that road to make it a better bill. And that is based on what Ms. Stark said a moment ago, that consultation is valuable between mental health providers and physical health providers. The evidence is clear. We also have very important data from the California Medicaid program, where there's a very strong correlation between the highest cost patients in the California Medicaid program are those patients that have comorbidity. They have a mental health diagnosis and a physical health diagnosis, depression and diabetes, depression and hypertension, those kinds of things. So if we can consult and break down those walls, that's a good thing for the patients, and it's a good thing for the program. We're concerned that being just from the perspective of physician assistants, we are concerned that APRNs who, like PAs, do not provide therapy services, do provide prescribing services, are in the bill, and PAs are not. They're very similar in terms of what they do, the patients they see, and there seems to be some equity issues there. Limiting the MA payments to just the APRNs and the psychologists and not other mental health providers like PAs, in a sense, would be like saying we're going to have Medicaid benefits for folks that live in a 507 area code of Senator Rosen, but not those same benefits in a 763, a 218, or a 952 area code. There's just, if this is a good thing to do, then let's do it for everybody. If it's not a good thing to do, then let's not do it. But letting APRNs get paid for their non-therapy medication management services and not PAs is a problem for us, and we appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. Dr. Stark came.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to be argumentative here, but my understanding is that PAs do not have training in psychotherapy or in therapeutic interventions, and they primarily look at medications. So it's not quite what we're aiming at here. I know that I'll just stop there.
Okay. Any further questions of members? Seeing none. Anyone else in the audience care to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 373? Seeing none. Senator Rosen, any further comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rosen moves Senate File 373 as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, and in addition, laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, members.
And with that, we are adjourned. Oh. Well, I don't. We don't have a bill before
I know
us.
It's not a bill. While you're all here, I'm a parent. This is a little girl, so awesome. I go all off campus, and we have the opportunity to read them over. And believe it or not, contrary to what many lobbyists are telling you, my child does not have autism because I sent her home because I'm a bad parent.
Miss, no lobbyist has told us that. No lobbyist has told any of us, to the best of my knowledge, that you are responsible for your child's autism in any way, shape, or form. I need to assure you of that.
I handed you a packet that talked a lot about the